Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh, yeah. Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Clap your hands.
Good morning, everyone. You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM with me, Priya, and with Alice.
Good morning, Priya.
How's it going?
Oh, I didn't get raptured, which is disappointing. But
yeah, I've heard, you know what? That is one of those things where usually I feel like I'm too online, but I heard people talking about the rapture and I had no idea what. Do you want to give us a rundown of what was expected?
Oh, I'm actually pretty tangential to this one. Normally, I'm really on my eschatology, but this one was some, I think Australian? No, South African pastor was like, I had a dream. Jesus told me that it's going to be, you know, last Tuesday. And as far as I know, it didn't really happen, but.
Yes. I mean, the amazing thing about a lot of those kinds of predictions is that they can always be retroactively explained after they don't happen. So I look forward to the next rapture announcement.
Oh, I can't wait.
I'll keep an eye out. So we've got a packed show for you today, and some of the content's pretty heavy, but I think pretty important. So we're going to start off by hearing the first part of a conversation that Inez had in the lead up to the AFL Grand Final this week with Meg Bagnall, Rachel Daniels, and Christine Dutoit, who all work at the intersections of alcohol and other drug use, domestic and family violence, and gambling in sports spectatorship. And they also explore strategies for change at all levels. So in this first part, they're going to discuss what domestic and family violence is and the social and gender drivers of violence and how Grand Final Day can intensify risk and harm.
And then following that, we'll have episode 3 of our podcast, Our Stories, Our Flats, produced by Ian Shoa. On this week's episode, residents discuss accessibility and safety in the flats.
Cool. And then after that, we're going to hear the second part of the conversation that Inez had with Meg, Rachel, and Christine about how the grand final is a time of celebration, but it also amplifies risks for family violence when substance use, gambling, losses, and socially expected hegemonic masculinity combined with gender drivers of violence are all in the mix. So in that second part of the interview, they're going to talk about what safety planning looks like at all levels.
And then we'll have Tony Birch in the studio. Tony Birch is a multi-award-winning author, and he'll be joining us to discuss the upcoming launch of Pictures of You, a selection of the best of his short fiction works over the past 2 decades.
Yeah, I'm so excited to have Tony in to talk about this amazing collection of works, and I'm really looking forward to that interview. And finally, we're going to hear the second part of Alice's interview that we played the first part of last week with Tyler and Danny from Crisis Housing Reform, which is a grassroots advocacy campaign focusing on change within Victorian crisis accommodation. And this interview is discussing two special reports released in late August this year from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare concerning youth experiencing homelessness. Now, remember, if you want to go back and listen to part one of that interview, you can head to 3cr.org.au/Thursday-breakfast. We'll be back to you shortly with the news headlines for this week.
Want to become a socially progressive podcaster but don't know where to start?
3CR has a wealth of podcasting knowledge and experience, and we've developed a practical podcast training course to help community voices get into the world of podcasting.
Our 2-day in-station course is perfect for new podcasters or people who want to improve their skills and get some insider tips.
Enroll now for our October podcast course.
full details at 3cr.org.au/podcast services.
Or call the station during business hours on 03 9419 8377.
Enroll now for our October podcast course.
These are the news headlines for Thursday the 25th of September. In reaction to the Labour government's decision to recognise the state of Palestine earlier this week, many Palestinians have spoken about the emptiness of the symbolic move, given it comes from countries complicit in Israel's genocide and apartheid. Residents in Ramallah in the West Bank this week said that such recognition feels insulting, saying that Palestinians already exist, but remain trapped in Israel's occupation through relentless and violent expansion of settlements and deepening control over resources in the West Bank. The Albanese government's refusal to sanction Israel or halt arms exports comes as Israeli forces intensify air and ground assaults in Gaza City, flattening neighborhoods, displacing hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, and destroying health facilities. Al Jazeera reported this week that Israel is killing at least 100 Palestinian people daily, and Gaza's health ministry has warned patients face certain death as fuel shortages force hospital closures.
Also in headlines this week, Melbourne City Council has proposed an intergovernmental review to reduce disruption caused by weekly protests, including pro-Palestine marches, as part of its draft council plan for the next 4 years. Human rights experts and some councillors criticised the review, warning that any new measures must not undermine the right to peaceful assembly, which is protected under both Victorian and international law. This comes as the Human Rights Law Centre in NAR makes a submission to the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the right to freedom of peaceful assembly, urging an investigation into New South Wales' adoption of a carceral anti-protest regime. The correspondence cites a violent incident in June this year when anti-protest laws were used as the basis for dispersal and arrest of a pro-Palestinian protesters that caused severe injuries to protester Hannah Thomas, including loss of sight in one eye. A police officer has now been charged in relation to that incident.
In related news, Melbourne City Council will spend $2 million on what they describe as a security program for the Central Business District, despite criticism that homeless people and community health organisations were excluded from consultations. Councillor Dr. Olivia Ball has condemned the plan, warning that new community safety officers equipped with handcuffs and arrest powers represent a misuse of public funds. Critics, including the Homeless Persons Union and community health providers, say the initiative targets homeless people and risks worsening trauma rather than addressing root causes like housing and mental health. Under the plan, the council is also investing millions into CCTV expansion with state government support, a move critics say signals a troubling shift towards punitive measures.
In other news, and First Nations listeners, please note that this headline contains mention of a First Nations person who has died. 4 months after the killing in police custody of Kumanjai White in a Coles supermarket in Mbanto Alice Springs in the Northern Territory, police have finally completed the autopsy and handed evidence to prosecutors. Mr. White's grandfather, Ned Jumpajimpa Hargraves, said the family had already waited too long for answers and have been let down again and again by the system, and are calling for an independent inquiry given their lack of trust in the Northern Territory Police. Earlier this week, protesters in NARM targeted a historic Coles building, calling out the supermarket chain for failing to release CCTV footage of the killing and connecting the public with the reality of the systemic racial violence built into corporate forces such as Coles and the Northern Territory Police. Now, for First Nations listeners, if you do want to speak to somebody about that, you can always call 13YARN, that's 139276.
Finally, in headlines, environmental groups have condemned Labor's newly announced 2035 greenhouse target of 62 to 70% as inadequate and greenwashing, warning it falls far short of the cuts needed to avoid catastrophic climate impacts. Critics say the government's continued approval of new coal and gas projects, reliance on creative statistics and accounting, and subsidies for unproven technologies like carbon capture show it as prioritising fossil fuel interests over climate action. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 25th of September. You're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
Help 3CR raise funds by donating your containers. Every eligible drink container that you return to a Container Deposit Scheme recycling point earns 10 cents, which can really add up. 3CR is a donation partner for Victoria's Container Deposit Scheme. The scheme allows you to recycle selected aluminium, glass, or plastic containers and donate the funds earned to a not-for-profit organisation of your choice. Help us raise funds for the station. Search for Community Radio and choose 3CR next time you cash in your cans. Go to cdsvic.org.au for more information.
You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 7:11 in the morning. With the AFL Grand Final on this weekend, we have a really important two-part interview that we're going to play for you today that touches on some of the darker sides of sports fandom and the footy celebrations. So, just a content warning, this discussion is going to be centered around domestic and family violence, which some listeners may find distressing. For support, you can always call 1-800-RESPECT. And if you're in immediate danger, call 000. And we'll provide further support details in this interview and also in the show notes. But if you do want to skip this segment, you can come back to us in around 15 minutes. So with the AFL Grand Final coming up this weekend, Inez is joined by Meg, Rachel and Christine, who work at the intersections of alcohol and other drug use, domestic and family violence and gambling in sports spectatorship, and explore strategies for change at all levels. In this first part, we're going to discuss what domestic and family violence is, the social and gendered drivers of violence, and how Grand Final Day can intensify risk and harm. Meg Bagnall is the statewide coordinator of the Specialist Family Violence Advisor Program in the alcohol and other drug sector, known for embedding gender-responsive approaches to substance use and family violence reform across Victoria. Rachel Daniels is a Specialist Family Violence Advisor with Ballarat Community Health, known for her expertise in substance use exploitation and parenting in the context of family violence, bringing a regional lens to systems change. And Christine Dutois is the U-Turn program leader and is a specialist family violence advisor with Windana, with deep expertise at the intersection of substance use and family violence and redevelopment of Victoria's alcohol and other drug assessment tools.
Thanks so much for joining us here today, Rachel, Christine and Meg. How are you all today?
Thank you.
I know this is a topic that is very challenging to navigate, and it's something that we're all really passionate about. So before we dive in, I thought that we could like lay the scene a little bit and introduce each of you.
Thanks, Inez. Thanks so much for having us. My name's Meg. I work with the Victorian Alcohol and Drug Association, also known as VADA. My role at VADA is Family Violence and AOD Lead. And part of my role, I get to work with the Specialist Family Violence Advisors in Alcohol and Other Drugs, who are with me today. And we're here to talk about the relationship between gambling, substance use, and the perpetration of family violence from our perspective, coming from the alcohol and other drug sector, as we see the harms that occur to community.
And what about you, Christine and Rachel?
I'm Christine. I'm a specialist family violence advisor at Windana. I'm also a program lead for our Men's Behaviour Change program that we run, which is called U-Turn. And my expertise is with the intersection of AOD and family violence, and I work with men.
Hi, I'm Rachel. I am a specialist family violence advisor across the AOD sector, and I work in the Central Highlands region. So, based in Ballarat, so out of the city. You know, part of my role is to bring a family violence lens to the work that AOD clinicians are doing, and to make sure that we are identifying and assessing and responding to family violence in that space, you know, bringing an understanding of the different types of violence and, yeah, doing some training and all of those things across the AOD sector.
And I know when it comes to family violence and alcohol and other drugs and particularly sporting events, we're talking about this in a very, like, hegemonic masculine catalyst kind of events that the grand final day sometimes can be. And obviously not attributing that to only one day or simply just a substance use, but I'm wondering if you could talk about why sporting events such as grand final day tend to amplify this.
Just to give you a statistic on that is that there's 2 days in the all of Australia that's really, really puts a lot of pressure on police force in terms of family violence. The calls for family violence incidents actually escalate about by at least 20%. One of those days is Christmas, and that's an Australian-wide day. The other day is very much a Victorian day, and that's our grand final day.
And certainly, I think, to speak from a regional perspective, it's been noted over the past couple of years at least, statistically, that family violence services in regional areas see an increase of 30 to 40% of in calls and people reaching out for assistance over grand final weekend in Victoria. So, and given that we know that statistically, again, in Australia at the moment, the most unsafe place for women and children is at home, the fact that that's increasing over this weekend is can be pretty scary for a lot of victim survivors, particularly knowing that alcohol will play a big role this weekend.
Is it alcohol? Is it kind of the big event of the day or the social permission that you get for aggression that plays out in that, you know, intimate partner setting?
I think it is a combination of all of those things. When it comes to family violence and alcohol use, it is when it's not the sole reason why family violence happens. There needs to be other drivers in place for that to happen. But when you're using substances or alcohol, what happens is your inhibition goes down, your what's the right and what's wrong, kind of like, I think gets a little bit influenced. Your decision-making is really, really not, gets impaired. And so what happens in this space is that it is very well researched, very well, we see this all the time, is that when there's alcohol involved, the severity and the frequency of family violence will increase, and it will escalate exponentially. And then on top of that, if you put something in like it's a really emotionally, I guess, charged a day with your team either winning or losing, if you've gambled and maybe you've lost more money than what you potentially wanted to, the way that you are going to be behaving in public, and if you put substances in there, particularly alcohol in there, you're going to take that behavior and you're going to take it straight home to the women and children that are home. So the person that's yelling at the referee, constantly screaming about these bad decisions, about whatever it is that's being happened, the pushing and the shoving that happens afterwards, whatever happens, that behavior is going to go straight home. And that's going to be witnessed by, you know, the children, and it's going to be experienced by partners at home.
Yeah, it sounds like from what I'm hearing is obviously not everybody that uses substances will use family violence, or anybody that's passionate about the grand final day. But it sounds like for those who do use violence, substance use seems to amplify the severity and the frequency. I know family violence is quite often, or intimate partner violence is also quite cyclical. Is it similar to what would happen maybe like every week or on like particular days, like anniversaries, Christmases, birthdays?
Well, I think when we look at things like the cycle of violence, I guess the AFL Grand Final, for example, would be a high trigger point in some families and relationships where there is already perhaps family violence or intimate partner violence occurring. For a lot of victim survivors, for example, they're very aware of that cycle of violence. And so this week, particularly leading up, a lot of people will be kind of walking on eggshells. They will be preparing themselves for what may or may not happen on the weekend. The person using violence as team wins, loses, as Christine said earlier. Yeah. What that might then look like when that person comes home from watching the football, or at home while they're watching the football, particularly then with substances, namely alcohol, on top of that. So
the gambling and you know, substance use and things like that. If you look at someone who has lost all of their money, it's a maybe rent or it might have been whatever it is that has been that's been lost. There's also that added financial burden that's going to come after. So how are we going to get food? How are we going to get pay the rent? That might even escalate that as well, because now there's an added stressful financial reasons that's added on top of it. So it's this whole thing that is, regardless of whether someone loses, regardless of whether someone wins, it's the fact that there's substance use, someone's going home, and the behaviours might be heightened to the person who's home.
It's the longer term impact. Yes. So I think all of the money is gambled away. There's no ability to pay rent, buy groceries, you know, medical bills, anything that the family needs to have finances for. And then that's all of a sudden not available. Depending on the types of family violence behaviours occurring in that home, if there is things like financial abuse that then can play out, and victim survivors often are left to somehow recoup that money, you know, what might look like one day, but it's the impacts post that day as well.
Yeah. And I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit more about how gambling can really amplify these effects. That's not just around substance use. So then I really want to zoom out and think about how a lot of this is systemic and how to safety plan.
When we talk about gambling, one of the things that we need to understand is that when gambling fits into the cycle of family violence, when it turns into financial abuse, he might be the only person that's providing a financial income, because she might be at home with the children, and it's okay for him to gamble, but it's not okay for her to get, I don't know, her hair done or or buy new clothes for the kids or buy clothes for herself. But it's okay, I've got money to gamble, but you're not allowed to do this because there's no money. It's like the my money, your money kind of thing. When you are spending that money, have you made the decision that that money really is available, or are you taking the money away from the children and your partner, particularly if you're the sole provider? If you lose all of this that you want to lose, is there going to be enough money to pay for everything else, to actually look after the family? Or is it going to be patient, but it might just be that, okay, well, now she is the one that needs to go and sit at Centrelink for the whole day in order to get some sort of payment now, because you've decided that it's okay to spend this kind of money. Or she's the one that needs to ask family members for financial support, kind of thing.
There's also increased feelings of shame associated with gambling. And so one of the things that we know as a catalyst for or justification for perpetrating family violence is to remove those feelings of shame. You want to get rid of them because they feel really horrible. And very often that translates in the perpetration of family violence. Yes. We also know, thinking about those co-occurrences, that there is an increased rate of suicide associated with gambling risk and complexity. So when we add in family violence, we're also now not just considering as a workforce increased risk of the perpetration of family violence and homicide. When gambling is present, and we're also thinking about homicide, suicide as well. So it just increases the amount of complexity that we see in the alcohol and other drug scene.
I think too, when we look at when we bring substance use into that, we also know that when it comes to homicides related to family violence, that there is a large there's substance use is identified prior to the homicide occurring and during as well.
Yeah. And if you want to put substance use on top of the gambling, it's once again that impaired ability to make a decision. My $10 now turned into $100. Mm-hmm. And then after $100, it turns into $200. And now it's just I'm doing whatever it is that I want to be doing. My card is out and I'm swiping in left, right and center, or clicking on all of the apps that's available, because I am now too impaired to actually make the decision about whether this money is really available or not.
Part of what we see in the sector is that not everybody goes to the football or goes out to celebrate to friends' houses. Very often people will be within their own home.
Yeah.
They'll be drinking. They're encouraged at every single point to gamble, gambling with the activity of watching sport.
And drinking,
that's right, which all feed into this social expectation around very toxic masculinity. So we're thinking about, and you mentioned it before, verbally abusing the players and the umpires as you're watching, screaming at your TV. I'm sure many people can relate to experiences of witnessing that. But then you're in the home, in the environment with your family, children, and verbal abuse, punching walls, getting upset, being aggressive, all of that is socially accepted when it comes to big sporting events and actively amplifies experiences of family violence.
But I wanted to touch on the point of shame, because that can be complicated, particularly for people who use violence, particularly men who use violence. But I think sometimes it can be an assumption that once the shame is like converted into violence, it's just there. But often it is the women and the children and the families that have to kind of absorb the shame of the person using violence. And I think society really puts that on. I know we call for so much about cultural accountability, but there are so many ways, like little ways, that we excuse this kind of violence every single day. And I'm wondering if you could, speak to some of that.
First of all, is the big misconception about what family violence is. In my experience working with men, particularly when they come into the service, is that they believe that they've done nothing wrong because they didn't hit someone. There was no physical violence. So there's a big assumption that the only violence that gets perpetrated at home is when you hit someone. And I think that's unfortunately because it's the only violence that gets reported, really, and reported on in the media. It's much more nuanced. It's more rife. It's more integrated in the way that we raise children, the way that we solve problems and solve problems in relationships, and the way that men move through the world. It's okay for me to yell at someone when I'm unhappy about something, and it is okay for me to come home really angry and throw my keys. Everybody hides because they don't want to confront me because of the way that I move through the world. And it's sometimes a really big blind spot for men because they don't realize that they have all of that moving through the world. Whereas women and children, we scurry away when we're faced with that because of the potential of how dangerous that could be.
You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 7:26 in the morning, and you just heard the first part of an interview where Inez spoke with Meg Bagnall, Rachel Daniels, and Christine Dutoit about what domestic and family violence is, the social and gendered drivers of violence, and how AFL Grand Final Day can intensify risk and harm. Remember, if you do want to speak to anyone, if this has raised any issues for you, you can call 1-800-RESPECT on 1-800-737-732. And you can also call the Kids Helpline on 1-800-551-800. 3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings. Cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
We're going to listen now to episode 3 of the podcast, Our Stories, Our Flats, produced by Ayan Shoa. On this week's episode, residents discuss accessibility and safety in the flats.
Our Stories, Our Flats acknowledges the traditional owners of the Kulin Nations. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present.
I think Carlton is a melting pot. It's a diaspora of different people. It's a place where a lot of different communities come together, and I think for the most part they live in harmony.
That was Saddam Ahmed explaining what makes the Carlton Flats a dynamic place to live. More from him later in the show. Welcome to Our Stories, Our Flats, a four-part podcast series about living and thriving in the Carlton Public Estates. Our Stories, Our Flats was created by and for the residents of the Carlton Flats. Written, produced, and edited by Ayan Shoa. Narration by Raven. It is a 3CR podcast. Special thanks to the City of Melbourne for helping us share it with the world. The Carlton Flats is home to residents from all walks of life. In this episode, you'll hear a snapshot of our community. On today's show, Saddam Ahmed discusses accessibility issues in the flats. Later in the episode, an anonymous resident shares her concerns about safety in the flats. We kick off the program with Saddam recalling a memory from school that stayed with him.
So I'm Saddam, I'm 33 and I've lived in Carlton since 1997, July of 1997. I think the best memory is probably going to the local school. It has challenges, but it really gave me resilience. So I enjoyed going to the school, even though it was a bit challenging. The only visually impaired student in the class, so, you know, that made it a bit difficult interacting with my peers and the people around me or the classmates, but it was quite dynamic, and I think I got the best support, but I think it sometimes wasn't a nurturing environment, looking back. I think it did me well in the end. I went to a specialist school as well as being mainstream educated, and I think that helped to offset the environment that I was in, which wasn't, you know, I think conducive to a blind person. I think it's not the fault of the teachers. I think they were not trained in dealing with visual impairment because it's a specialized area. And so I think they did the best they could with the resources they had, but definitely going to a specialist school did help me in my education to, you know, to get the fundamentals and to get that specialist support. I think that was very important decision that was made.
Residents we've spoken to have expressed frustration about how the redevelopment plan was reported to the community.
It was poorly mismanaged, the way that it was conveyed. I think it could have been communicated more promptly and also with a bit more compassion. I think that these buildings maybe have reached end of life, so maybe sometimes it's good to have a fresh start, but I think it wasn't communicated very well and the community's fears weren't addressed properly. I think definitely the government should have done better to convey what was going on better. No, I didn't get anything accessibly. I just heard it through the grapevine, and also, you know, there was some door knocking that was going on, but I didn't get any accessible literature or anything like that. That's a good example, I think, as well, that, you know, documentation wasn't handed out in accessible format, and you know, it just was very poorly conveyed. And even now, I think it's a lot of the details are quite murky, I mean, to this day. So I hope for the best that something like this will have a positive effect. But, you know, it's a grand scale of movement. I think there will be disappointment and tears. But maybe the, you know, a fresh start is, I think, good. But it's definitely poorly mismanaged and not conveyed well at all.
So with the building, how would you describe the accessibility standard? Is it accessible? And if not, what could be done differently?
There's Braille on the lifts, and the lifts do talk. But I think that the design of getting around it, I think, can be sometimes challenging. Certainly where I am, I found the previous building that I was in was more conducive to a blind person to get around. You know, a lot of places here, like, they're adjacent and there are corridors that go into different, to funny places, that kind of thing. So definitely some of the buildings are more friendly than others, I would say.
Do you feel like you could advocate for yourself and for your community with housing? Is it easier to do, or are you more on the cautious side when it comes to, like, advocating for the things that you need in the building?
I think I'm a good advocate for myself, and I, you know, stand up for where I can. But, you know, it's an exhausting process. So, you know, you want to take care of your mental health. So, you know, I pick my battles where I need to fight, but, you know, you can't fight everything. So I think you have to be strategic with these kind of things. So I started Accessible Technology Solutions when I finished my studies, and back in 2016. And the main reason for starting it is, you know, employment can be very tough for people living with disability. You know, there's a lot of resources out there, but employers traditionally have been very reluctant to take on people with disabilities. And so it's a chance for myself to carve out a small niche for myself. And, you know, we do accessibility consulting for companies to make their apps and websites more accessible for people that use adaptive technology, like a screen reader. And it was just started off as a little hobby to sort of build my own website, but it's turned into sort of my own side hustle and something that I'm very proud of, because it not only gives me revenue, but it gives me a sense of purpose, and which I'm very proud of.
Blind or vision impaired individuals face discrimination in the job market. A 2021 employment survey by Vision Australia found that more than half of employers had never considered hiring a person with a vision impairment. These are stark figures,
While workplaces try to catch up, residents like Saddam Ahmed have had to create opportunities for themselves. Saddam is an example of the resourcefulness of marginalized communities.
You're listening to Our Stories, Our Flats, a 3CR podcast by and for the residents from the Carlton Public Flats.
Next is a former teacher from South America who has chosen to remain anonymous. We asked her thoughts on safety and security in the flats.
I am a woman. I have been a teacher for many, many years. I studied in my country. When I came to Australia after maybe 2 years, I started to teach again, and I had a really good time with my students. I have taught ESL, and within ASL, I did literacy, and which was really, really interesting. It was a pleasure to be with my students. We had a really, really good time. They learned a lot, and we were all happy together. And I've been in Carlton for some years, which I can't remember how many years, but I remember when I came to Australia, I was alone. I lived in different places. I went to live in St Kilda. I got very scared because where I live, in my flat, there were just windows at the front. My neighbor was an Australian man who was coming from prison. I was not scared of the guy, but the problem was that he found a girlfriend. They went out together, and when they came back, all the friends were with alcohol and a bit of substance abuse, so I was really worried that they could come into my flat through the windows, because there were just windows. Then I live in Fitzroy, and they demolish the apartments, so I live in many different places. I think before that, I needed to find somewhere to live, so I applied to be in housing, and I remember they gave me to leave a flat in the red flats. And I went, and the red flats were so tiny, and one of them was very high, maybe level 16. I got very scared and claustrophobic. They gave me another flat. I can't remember which floor, but I found it the same. I mean, too tiny. And they said to me, okay, if you don't accept the next one, we won't give you anything. So they gave me one here in Carlton, a bit closer to transport, and the flats were bigger, and I was really happy in my flat. I felt safe. I felt secure. I have a place to live, because I have always been like independent. I mean, and I live alone. I wasn't scared to live in Carlton. I remember when I was younger, I used to go dancing in Fitzroy, and I walked from Fitzroy here sometimes at 3 o'clock in the morning alone. Sometimes we came with friends, but at the time it wasn't dangerous at all. I was very happy because there was always people in Carlton, and I felt secure and in a way more like my country, where you see people. You're not like in Dandenong, that after 5 o'clock you see no one, and it's very, very scary. People who really could injure you, I mean, if they want to. And now when I call to complain, they answer the phone, and they sent someone, because I had a problem with a neighbor who was, I don't know what, he has a factory upstairs. He makes a lot of noise, hammering, nailing, cutting, throwing, like he throws a whole mattress on the floor, the whole bed. Oh my God, sometimes I felt that he was going to break the ceiling, and he was going to go through the ceiling on my floor. That happened for many years. I went, I wrote notes and letters, and no, they did nothing, absolutely nothing. They said to us, or to me, write it down. They never ever did anything.
Carlton Flats are one of the few places older residents can find affordable housing. 1 in 7 Australians experiencing homelessness is aged 55 and over. When private developers demolish our homes, where will residents like our anonymous guest be housed? Will they return to public housing once the new apartments are built? These are important questions that need answers. If you're interested in learning more about the experience of older residents in housing, check out Housing for the Aged Action Group. Housing for the Aged Action Group also hosts a radio show on 3CR Community Radio called Raise the Roof. We'll share their details in the show notes. In the final episode of Our Stories, Our Flats, we speak to Aku from 44 Flats United, and Barry from the North Melbourne Flats shares what inspired him to take Homes Victoria to court. To learn more about housing justice, head over to our 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/Our Stories, Our Flats. Our Stories, Our Flats is written, produced and edited by Ayan Shoiwa. Narration by Raven.
That was episode 3 of Our Stories, Our Flats. If you would like more information about Our Stories, Our Flats or want to listen back to the first 2 episodes of the series, visit 3cr.org.au/Our Stories, Our Flats, or one word. We'll be playing the final episode on our show next week, so don't miss out.
And we're going to head straight into our next segment, which is the second part of the interview that we began earlier in the show, where Inez was speaking to Meg Bagnall, Rachel Daniels and Christine Dutoit about the AFL Grand Final as a time for celebration, but also as a time that amplifies risks for family violence when substance use, gambling losses and socially expected hegemonic masculinity is combined with gendered drivers of violence. Now, again, content warning, this discussion is centered around domestic and family violence. So if you do need to speak to someone, you can always call 1-800-RESPECT. That's 1-800-737-732 or the Kids Helpline on 1-800-551-800. Now, in the second part of this interview, they're going to discuss what safety planning looks like at all levels, from the person perpetrating the violence, the people experiencing the violence, friends and family, as well as community. And they're going to speak about a range of intervention strategies and, importantly, not placing the sole responsibility on the victims of violence to deal with this alone. Now, if you want to tune out and come back to us after we play this segment, you can return in about 18 minutes.
I'm wondering, if you could talk through what safety planning or harm reduction kind of does look like for people who experience family or intimate partner violence in a range of different ways.
I guess from a man's perspective, because I do think that men should start taking responsibility for actually keeping their family safe. Now, if you're going to go and be drinking at Grand Final, before you start having your drinks, before the weekend starts, have some sort of plan in place about what it is that I'm going to do, what it is that I'm not going to do. When am I going to stop drinking? It's a very simple thing. How many beers am I allowed to have? What am I allowed to have? Am I allowed to have whiskey as well? Or am I only going to drink? What kind of alcohol am I going to drink? And how many am I going to have? And then have that conversation and have that plan in place while you're not substance affected, while you are still in control, while you still want to make sure that control is probably not the right word, while you're still able to make decisions that are rational and going to have the safety of your family in the forefront. If you're going out and you're going to be at the footy and you're going to be on the stadium and the pavilion, maybe have that conversation with the friends that you're with. Oh, Bob doesn't have a family at home. Maybe it's going to be a good idea if I sleep on his couch tonight. And then when I go home, I'm going to be not drunk or not substance affected, so which means that I'm going to be safer to be around. Or maybe if Bob sees me yelling at the ref with a red face, maybe he can say to one, look, maybe it's not a good idea for you to go home right now because it looks like you're very upset with what happened tonight. I've got a free couch for you. That, I think, is a safety plan from a personal point of view about what it is that I'm going to do that is going to make sure that I don't frighten my family and that I don't speak to my family in a way that's going to be degrading and that I don't actually take out whatever it is on my partner and my children. And who of my mates is going to be the ones that can support me to do that if I'm going out? But if I stay home, there needs to be because most of the time that type of planning is done by women and children, and they're not the ones who are out there drinking and doing all of these things. So that from a male perspective is maybe just think about this before you just go into the weekend.
We sort of got to a point in community and in society where we understand family violence more. We understand a lot of that nuanced sort of aspects of the behaviours that are that we see in family violence. Historically, we know that the onus for keeping women and children safe is sat with women and children. So, you know, in relation to safety planning, they know their partners and their fathers, you know, they know the behaviours, the patterns. So we really need to be hearing their voices. But certainly what we encourage always, if people feel that there's imminent risk to their safety, 000, call police for assistance. If you feel like you're at imminent risk of being harmed. But also thinking about things like, is there somewhere safe that we can go? Is there people that we trust, that we feel safe with, family, friends, that understand the situation? We can go and stay there for the night till things calm down, and then return home the next day. Thinking about, you know, having a bag packed just in case. Preparation, having phone numbers in your phone if it's safe to do so, the safe steps for your local Orange Door or After Hours Family Violence Services as well. But I think it's just, as women, I think we know in the community, we keep ourselves safe. Women are forever risk assessing, and also thinking about, you know, what risks are out there. And we do that in our homes as well. So it's really just about thinking ahead. If I need to leave, can I leave safely? Do I have access to money, access to transport, access to somewhere safe to go? Or if I am at home, is there a room in the house that we can go to that will be safe, that we can just kind of be away from the risk,
yep,
until it's safe to come back out?
And on that, if I could just highlight how much preparation goes into it, if you're a woman with a child trying to leave, where for a man it is basically maybe stop at 2 beers, don't yell at the TV, don't punch a wall. That's your safety plan, and no one has to do all of these things, or just one person sleeping on a couch instead of having, do I have access to money? Have I got a safe space? Do I have enough phone numbers? The safety planning, if you're a man who's going to be drinking and gambling and possibly engaging in behaviours that might be frightening to your partner and your children, your safety plan is the small, whereas her safety plan is massive, and there's so much consideration that needs to go into it. So I think for me it's a no-brainer about who actually needs to do the safety plan, rather than, you know, this massive ordeal.
And I think too, you know, when we look at systems and services that are out there as well, leading into particularly this weekend, knowing that the AFL Grand Final is coming up, services, for example, police, our you know, local Orange Doors, Safe Steps, they will be pre-planning and pre-preparing to meet demand. And that might look like booking motel rooms ahead of time. So knowing that, you know, we're also in school holidays, you know, a lot of access to what is used for emergency accommodation to keep women and children safe may well be booked. So a lot of services have pre-booked emergency accommodation ready for this weekend.
Yeah.
So, you know, services as well, you know, are preparing and safety planning to meet the demands of what we know will be an increase in incidences over the weekend.
And I think it's really interesting that we're in this position as a society and as a community, that we really do allow for the social permission giving of this kind of behaviour during major sporting events for a very particular gender.
Yeah.
And it's such a shame that we're here when so much harm is caused. And I suppose one of the things we've been considering in preparing is this a social permission giving that we're comfortable with? Should we be reassessing how we encourage social behaviours during major sporting events when they cause so much harm? And how is it acceptable socially to be to be amplifying and justifying and supporting such aggressive behaviours in public and in private. As a society, I think we have a lot to think about.
Yeah, definitely. And I know, you know, we want to really want to emphasise, yeah, it's not only on the people who are experiencing the harm to safety plan and hold all of that, which so often they always do. But I think it can be really hard when you're maybe like scared of the police, or you're not sure about which service to go to, or which friend is like safe to talk about this with, particularly if you have like mutual friends with your partner. So yeah, I'm wondering if people are, like, particularly women and children who are unsure about where to go, maybe don't feel comfortable calling the police yet or going to a service, like how do you even assess like how, which services is helpful or which friend is kind of, or family member is supportive? And maybe people will know that intuitively, but I also know that a lot of people don't.
It can be, yeah, and it can be really, really difficult for a lot of victim survivors. And sometimes, you know, sometimes people don't always have positive experiences with service systems for whatever reason. And so, you know, feeling safe and comfortable to reach out. And we know, you know, a lot of women, particularly, you know, when it does come to family violence and looking at, again, those coercive controlling behaviours, often perhaps won't feel safe to reach out because it might actually, you know, the stigma attached to, say, you know, a woman who is a substance user is much greater reaching out to the service system than it is for someone who is not a substance user. You know, we know then that, you know, there's a whole lot of other things. Child protection could become involved. You know, there may be other services that become involved. That so it's thinking about, and as I said, that's why it's important that we listen to the voice of women in safety planning, because if they don't feel safe to go to police or they don't feel safe to contact services, we need to look at safety planning with them around where do they feel safe.
Yes.
Where is a safe space for them that they can go that may not be part of a service system? And that's, I think, as I said, that's the importance of, you know, as a service system, us not further disempowering victim survivors by telling them what they need to do, or, you know, but listening and hearing what they say and what they know works for them. Women will have protective factors. They've kept themselves safe so far in these relationships. As a service system, part of our role is to then build on that with them.
Yeah.
So how can we then put more of a collaborative wraparound approach to safety, as opposed to it just being left the sole responsibility of that woman?
Yes. Yeah. And if you do, you have like family or friends, or if that, if you're a service worker and you suspect that maybe violence will escalate during grand final in a relationship where you see and you're like, I'm not really sure about this. I have a feeling something might be happening. I guess how do you, yeah, as a friend or a family or someone who cares about the people in there, like how do you reach out?
Yeah, I guess if you're concerned about a friend or a family member, it is just, maybe it is just inviting them to your house.
Yes.
For the week. Yeah. You come over for a meal, or, you know, bring the kids over, we'll have a sleepover, we'll watch a movie. You know, if it's family, you know, maybe organising a gathering or something, inviting that person, giving them an opportunity to move away from the risk without, I guess,
saying,
you know, creating a situation where that particular woman might then feel uncomfortable and go, oh, what are people thinking about me? Or, you know, are they talking about me behind my back? I don't feel comfortable or safe about that. But just kind of, you know, a general, what are you doing on the weekend? Do you want to perhaps come over with the kids on Saturday? The kids can hang out. We can, you know, do whatever, just as a trying to create some level of safety.
Yeah.
You can also reach out to 1-800-RESPECT and talk through what your loved one might be experiencing, or if you feel you may be experiencing it too, you can reach out to 1-800-RESPECT. Respect and talk through what your options are. 1-800-RESPECT usually also connect you in with the local supports.
Yes.
And if you are thinking about your safety around a family member who might be using substances, you can also link in with your local alcohol and drug service. If you don't know who that is, reach out to VADA and we can connect you through or share that information with you for some family counselling options. So we can, all community services are now legislated into the Marram framework. So all community services, including child and family services, maternal child health, everyone is legislated to respond to family violence. So if you're already connected with one of those services or you're not sure, alcohol and other drug services are a really great place to start.
Or your maternal health, health nurses, even your GP, everybody does have an idea of how to respond to family violence. You can just say, look, I think I'm at risk. And that person, so if you've got if you've got a really good maternal child health nurse, and you actually want to say to her, look, I think I might be at risk, she'll be able to link you in with the service. There's a lot more help out there than people realize. It's just that asking is I think, and we understand in the service, we understand that it's really difficult and very scary for people to ask, but also there's a lot of shame for people who are experiencing family violence as well, to actually ask. But if you notice something, if you're a community member and you notice something, particularly with a family member, like Rachel said, invite them over to a safe space. It doesn't need to be. We're having an intervention because of what's happening.
Yeah.
It can just be. Do you know what? I'm going to provide the space where I think you're going to be safe. And so, if there is if you really need that space again, you'll contact me and you'll come back. Just be open to be that safe space. If you're a family member, if you are a person who's trying to support a family member that you suspect is going through.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah, so I think from memory, some of the things that I've heard right now is like, hey, come over. Like, we're having a watch party. We'll watch a movie. Everybody can sleep over. If you're seeing like a friend at a game or when they're out and they're about to go home, you're like, hey, mate, how about you stay at mine?
Yes.
Instead of like heading home angry, we can play some Xbox or whatever. And I guess when it's a bystander, maybe a stranger at a game, I think sometimes that can feel uncomfortable, or people don't know what to do, and a lot of it is like, look away, let's pretend it's not happening. But if people do want to step in, or make sure the victim survivor knows that like, I'm seeing this, it's not okay, and also for the man who's perpetrating the violence to be like, maybe somebody's watching me. But that can be a really difficult situation. So I'm wondering if there are any tips to people that see.
Yeah, there really are. So in response to the deaths in custody last year or the end of the year before, the government introduced sober sites where people can sober up if they want to before going home.
Yeah.
And so there are two sites here in Metro. Regionally, it's a little bit more complicated.
We do have one in Ballarat.
Yes.
It's called the Public Intoxication Response Unit, but can be accessed for people to sober up in as well.
Yeah, so that could be an option for a member of public, but they are voluntary. And sometimes the police may transport individuals to those sites to access some social support and some health support as well. Look out for those, and I can share those with you as well.
Yeah, we'll definitely put it in our show notes as well. Yeah, there's so many other health services that are under the Marram network, so that if there is like a particular professional that you feel a little bit more comfortable with, that's maybe not like a particular family violence service, like even going to them can be really helpful. And just to finish off, is there anything that you would like to leave people with for the end of the day, the information I showed us as well?
The impact of family violence on women and children is far reaching. What children see right now is going to follow them into adulthood. It is going to impact how they raise their own children. It is a massive generational cycle that we need to take into consideration when we're talking about family violence and the nuance family violence. We're raising the next generation, and it's your responsibility to do better than the previous generation.
Weekends like Grand Final weekend, for example, is a real opportunity and a platform for these big, football sporting clubs to get on board and to want to do better and be better, we can take steps to change, flip the script basically, and make change for future generations moving forward.
Thank you so much, everybody.
Thanks, Ines.
And you are listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And that was the second part of a conversation between Inez, Meg Bagnall, Rachel Daniels, and Christine Dutoit about this weekend's coming AFL Grand Final and the risks around it for family violence when substance use, gambling losses, and socially expected hegemonic masculinity are all combined. And so in this second part of the interview, they talked about what safety planning looks like at all levels and a range of intervention strategies. And importantly, not placing the sole responsibility on the victims of violence to deal with this alone. Again, if you do need to speak with anyone about this, you can call 1-800-RESPECT on 1-800-737-732 or the Kids Helpline on 1-800-551-800. And we are now joined in the studio by multi-award-winning author Tony Birch to discuss the upcoming launch of Pictures of You, a selection of some of the best of his short fiction works over the past two decades. And this collection brings together some of Birch's most poignant stories, taking readers through the humor, heartbreak, and rich complexity of everyday human experience. Pictures of You is published by the University of Queensland Press and hits bookstores on the 30th of September. Good morning, Tony.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for coming in. It's always a pleasure to have somebody in the studio for an interview.
I love coming into the studio, but it's not far from home, so it's easy to get here.
True. Well, I am going to ask you a question about being in this place. So something that's always really stood out to me in your writing is how evocatively you create a sense of place. And so speaking from where we are now at 3CR, can you talk about how this place in the area of Fitzroy, Collingwood and Carlton in particular have shaped and continue to influence your writing?
Yeah, well, obviously I've spent most of my life in the inner city and spent a lot of my childhood here in Fitzroy. And even when we moved away, we didn't go far. I've lived in Richmond on Housing Commission, lived in Collingwood, lived in Carlton. So always I've lived in the inner city. I've always been a lifelong walker as well, so that, you know, even now I'm 68, I just got my driver's license, but I haven't really got behind a wheel yet. I'm not game. So I walk everywhere. I take a lot of photographs. Obviously, I have a lot of strong memories of place. So it does become very evocative, even though the stories may or may not be autobiographical. It's that I will get triggers or memories of place that really evoke stories. It's often been hard for me to write about other places. I remember as a teenager, I used to swim at the Yarra River under a bridge called the Catwalk Bridge, and I would gaze across the river to Hawthorne, and I always wondered what they do in Hawthorne. I still wonder what people do who live in Hawthorne, and I don't know if they have any writers, but I'd like something salacious to come out of Hawthorne. I just feel that this is my place. I feel that there are important stories to tell about this place. So one of the things I was thinking about walking up this morning, you know, when you think about issues around homelessness around the inner city, I've written, you know, homeless characters into a lot of my fiction, and I hope I've done that with respect, because I feel that people who are regarded on the margins of urban society, and of course the Aboriginal community of Fitzroy as well, that I like to create characters who allow me to place those sort of issues and those people at the centre of Fitzroy life and inner city life. So they are my people. It might sound patronising, but I feel at home with people who are not otherwise welcome in suburbs like this anymore.
Yeah, and I think it's been all the more present as a concern when we think about this next wave of urban renewal that's coming through with the public housing redevelopment that's been planned by the state government. And I guess I wanted to turn to asking about how Pictures of You came together. So what was the process of revisiting and selecting and then placing these stories together in this collection?
Well, first of all, it was just a wonderful experience. I've published five short story collections, and I think there would have been about 70 or 80 stories to choose from, and I could have included stories that have been published individually. To be quite honest, it's a bit like making a mixtape that you really love. So I didn't talk to the publisher about what they thought would work. I just felt that of the 22 stories, I think there are, that they were my favourites, and for different reasons, so that clearly there are issues important to me, like family violence. So I have written fiction based on my childhood experience of family violence. But there are also some what I might call very quiet stories in the collection, which might convey an evolution in me as a writer, although my most recent novel, Women and Children, is also about family violence. I think it's I wanted to show some range in my writing, and I wanted to, there are particular stories, a story, one of my all-time favourite stories, Bobby Moses, about an old Aboriginal man who's dying and wants to go home to country. I love that story, and I based that story or the character on Jackie Charles, who was a great mate of mine. And Jackie died not long after that story was published. So one of the reasons for publishing that is that I love it. But again, to pay respect to people who are important in my life. I mean, it's not unusual in my novels, like when I wrote The White Girl, to have characters called Lydia and Alma and Sissy, who are part of the great Thorpe family. So I always try to give cameos to my Aboriginal family. I have a prisoner called Foley in my new novel, which it may be a coincidence.
Yes, a fascinating coincidence. But I also, yeah, love Bobby Moses and the way that there is that quiet dignity that really comes through the character. I think about Amy McQuire's writing on the notion of presencing and the way that that really feels, I don't know, so resonant with the characters that you develop in your stories.
Yeah, and I think with Bobby Moses and thinking about Jackie, it might seem like an odd story because he and the policeman on the highway who could, you know, do really serious damage to Bobby, they negotiate something of a peace deal. And that might seem a bit too fanciful, but it's not, because if you knew Jackie knew how to negotiate the street, and part of Jackie's negotiation through his life, wherever he'd been in prison or working in the arts or being a respected elder, was to try and find ways to negotiate with anyone. I've seen Jackie calm a policeman in the street when that policeman might otherwise have harmed another Aboriginal person. So Jackie would see his role, all right, we know who the police are, but what I'm interested in here is to stop violence. So he was very good at charming and disarming people, which is a great skill of his.
Yeah, that's really beautiful, a beautiful way to honour that complexity. And I wanted to ask as well about the cover photo on the dust jacket, and maybe as well about, you know, the dedication as well on the back.
I love the photograph. So it's a photograph taken at Photo Booth on Flinders Street about 1970, so it's very old. It's a photograph of my younger brother Wayne and my little sister Tracy, who's sort of just poking her head up. So it's sort of a badly framed photograph in some ways, but I think it's wonderful. It's a photograph of my brother who died very suddenly 6 years ago now. He grew up in Fitzroy with us. He suffered a lot of mental illnesses as an older person. And I love that photograph of him because he's simply so beautiful. And I mean, it's a very soft, beautiful photograph. And my brother went through a dramatic physical transformation in later life. And, you know, there was nothing, any shame in that. But my mother particularly loves that photograph and wanted me to use it because she wanted people to see how beautiful he was. And I've said this before that, you know, in a family of six children, you would have thought he was adopted because the rest of us have pretty rough heads. And he was always this angelic, beautiful child. So I feel so attached to the photograph, and I was really rapt when my sister saw it, my mum saw it, and it's so important to us. But it also works. I think it works in a sense of design. So my book designer is a Larrakia woman, Jenna Lee, who's worked on most of my books with UKP. And I work closely with her about how to design covers, and she has done this book and other books, and I'm just really happy and proud to have worked with her.
Yeah, I love the hat motif. And it is, well, look, people are going to have to go out and get the book so that they can see it.
Or borrow it from the library, I don't
that
mind.
That is true. Ask your local library. You can always ask them to get a book in.
Yeah.
So, yes, getting back to the dust jacket and tying into the dedications on the back to Sara Saleh, Randa Abdel Fattah and Omar Sekar, I wanted to ask about that and maybe, you know, weaving that into the role of storytelling as a form of communication about the most important things in our world?
Well, each of those three writers are great friends of mine. They are great writers. They've also been very active in recent years in support of the nation and community of Gaza, been very vocal on the attempts to destroy Gaza, the genocidal intent of the Israeli Defense Force. And because of their courage and bravery, they've really suffered extreme abuse, I think violent abuse, and in the case of Rhonda in particular, attempts to destroy her as a person and her writing career. So we've dealt with some issues together over the last couple of years. My role is just to give them as much support as I can. And we particular in this year have had some very difficult issues to deal with, and we've just made a point of sticking close to each other. And I wanted to name them. That dedication also extends to making a comment about the cowardice of people in 2025. And what I mean by that is that the cowardice of not those who speak out in support of Israel, those who sit on their hands and say nothing when terrible things are being done. So I love all those people dearly, and I think their courage is amazing, as is the courage of all Palestinians living in Australia who get out on the streets and speak up for their community. And I think for the rest of us, we have an important role to play to support those people.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the way that we've seen silencing play out, you know, not just in the literary industry, but across society in Australia in relation to Palestine and the genocide, has been, you know, immensely harmful. And I guess I also wanted to ask about the importance of intentionally making or preserving space for storytelling. And here I wanted to ask about your reflections on the closure of Mianjin.
Yeah, well, I've been very active on this in recent weeks. I mean, not publicly, because there are people doing that. By that, I mean, if I could just make the point that my first academic article was published in Mianjin. I think I've probably published at least 10 pieces of writing in Mianjin, you know, in so-called academic essays, certainly in short fiction and poetry. I made a statement or a joint statement with other people from the creative writing program at Melbourne University recently that Mianjin, its continuation is vital to the support of young emerging writers, writers of colour, certainly to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander writers. Historically, Mianjin have been great supporters of us, and that if we don't have journals, magazines like Mianjin around it, it just lessens the opportunity for younger writers to be published. So that's vital and that's obvious. What we've done in recent weeks, we've done things like I am technically the chair of Australian Literature at the University of Melbourne. So I've written several times to the vice chancellor of the university to raise the issue and haven't had a response. But I am able to say, and I don't know the detail, there is now a shift in the decision. And I know that a working group has been established. I was in a meeting yesterday, and a working group has been established. We want to bring Mianjin back into the university, and hopefully Mianjin will continue to operate within the Faculty of Arts, probably in my school, the School of Culture and Communication. Now, that's a fair way down the track, but I suppose the point to make, and I made this at a university meeting earlier this week, is that what we feel is shameful is that the decision was made with no discussion as to how, if there were financial issues, if there were, that there was no discussion held with university staff about how we might deal with that and how we might alleviate that. So it's a very, very strange decision to make.
Mm. And University of Melbourne, famously financially constrained. Now, I just wanted to ask, to wrap up, what you're reading right now, and are there any up-and-coming writers whose work you'd like to see more widely recognised?
Well, I'd like to see up-and-coming writers, all of them, more widely recognised, but I've come with a recommendation. I've also come with a book, and I don't know how you people do this. I'm going to give you this book, so you're going to give it away somehow. Or, you know,
we'll figure it out.
People rush to the doors or something. So this is a first book by a Palestinian-Australian writer, Michaela Saha, and the title of the book is Find Me at the Jaffa Gate. It's a Palestinian family memoir. I know Michaela personally. This is a really important book for people who want to understand the struggles of the people of Palestine. So I would recommend that. Not as a newer writer, but I know Rhonda has a new novel out, Discipline. I think you should read that. But if I could just say generally, what I found in the last 2 years is that I have spoken publicly in support of Palestinians, but I pulled back a little bit on that because my sense is, one is I need to be a listener as much as a speaker or more. So I need to listen to our Palestinian comrades and friends. Secondly, I really spend as much time as I can reading Palestinian writers. So I think for all of us, you know, it's important to give support and it's important to be active. But I think we need to make sure that we are standing with our friends, not speaking on their behalf, and also that we're educating ourselves. And what I found by reading, whether it be fiction, poetry or nonfiction, I've always been someone who wanted to be aware of what's happened in Gaza historically, and I would think, yeah, I know a bit. I realised that I didn't know anything like I need to know, and I'm still on that journey. So I would urge everyone to read as many Palestinian writers, both in Australia and internationally, as you can, because you will become better informed. And if attack because someone says, oh, you don't understand history, well, you can say, no, I do understand history, and you're wrong.
Yeah, that is a perfect way to leave it. And, you know, at least from my own experience, you read Palestinian writing and it will change you forever. And you won't be able to see things differently. So, Tony, thank you so much again for joining us. We will figure out a way to sort out the giveaway. But yeah, just really appreciate you coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. And you are listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 8:16 in the morning.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
Content warning. The following segment contains discussions of child and adolescent mortality, domestic violence, and suicide. If anything covered causes distress or raises questions, you can contact the Suicide Callback Service on 1300 659 467, and First Nations listeners can also call 13YARN. That's 139276. This is the second part of an interview with Tyler and Danny from Crisis Housing Reform, a grassroots advocacy campaign focusing on change within Victorian crisis accommodation. We discuss two special reports released in late August this year from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare. The first report concerns children seeking support from specialist homelessness services who are unaccompanied, that is, those aged 12 to 17 who are not accompanied by a parent or guardian. And the second is about children who have died, who had a history of receiving specialist homelessness services support. Part one of the interview was broadcast last week, 18th September, and can be found on 3cr.org.au/Thursday-breakfast.
I'm Tyler. First experienced homelessness when I was in my early teens, sleeping on the street, crisis accommodation, different family violence services, mental health services. There were no single services that offered all of the assistance that I needed.
My name is Danny. My experience was being a solo parent, 22, had a 7-week-old baby and became homeless due to family violence. The system wasn't set up for me. I fell through the cracks. No refuge or anything. I had to couch surf with the baby until I found myself a private rental, which took several months.
I have been advocating in the service system for the last 3 years, trying to create change through advocacy and activism.
I am also here today to advocate for the system, things that need changing. The data that was recorded but not reported on, and there was data that wasn't actually collected. It was missing from the report.
It's all about manipulating the data to have the numbers show what you want them to show. The government doesn't want to take responsibility for the harm that they're causing to Indigenous communities.
It's a circular system that passes the responsibility back and forth between government bodies without anyone actually caring for children or young people in crisis.
People who are trans and gender diverse are forced to identify as female to be housed safely.
Being a youth-friendly service is more than using accessible language. It's accounting for the additional complex challenges that children face when experiencing homelessness.
There is a mental health impact that we don't talk about. You can't learn while you're in crisis, and homelessness is a crisis.
Their age is just a huge barrier to accessing so many systems.
This is a tool of the government for population control.
And the fact that homelessness takes all of your capacity to survive, so anything you do beyond that is an extra, so it shouldn't be an expectation to be doing anything other than survive.
Despite the methodological nature of reports such as these, and even with the possibility of the best of intent from its authors, bias is a persistent quality in human output. And I was wondering if you had any opinions on how this report uses data or how it chooses the lenses through which that data is examined.
They don't deserve the benefit of the doubt based on the history of their choices. There are very obviously intentional choices made in this report about what data was collected, what was reported on, and what was left out. The information is deliberately inaccessible when referring to minorities because they don't want us to have access to our own data. You know, they're willing to release this data about children dying because that can be used to lobby government for further funding for existing programs. Whether those programs have been proven effective or not, those programs look good when the government provides funding for them. They can say that they're fixing youth homelessness, even if they're not targeting young people with complex needs. And if you're homeless as a young person, you have complex needs. You know, they intentionally chose not to report statistics on minority groups. There's a lack of provision of disability services for unaccompanied children. They don't record data on children who've had contact with the legal system or over-policing or being criminalized. And young people who are incarcerated aren't counted as homeless, but prisons aren't homes. And we know that incarceration makes people more likely to become and stay homeless, yet there's no data around young people who have had contact with the legal system. They're deliberately vague and misleading. They use terms like people experiencing homelessness are impacted by housing crisis, in contrast with oversimplified explanations, like the explanation that some people experience long-term homelessness or quiet reasons for assistance. There's a distinction between self-assessed reason and service-assessed reason, but they don't give us information on how they access that self-assessed reason, whether they actually spoke to clients of SHS services.
Homelessness adversely affects physical and psychological well-being. Of children in Australia who died from 2023 to 2024, 1 in 13 had received specialist homelessness services during their life. The numbers increase with age, with 15%, or 1 in 7, of children who died aged 15 to 17 having received support. Suicide was the most common cause of death, 30% of children aged 12 to 15, and 43% of those aged 16 to 17. Could you offer any insight into how the framework as it currently exists is unsuccessfully supporting these children?
Suicide is linked with hopelessness. So if there's no support path in the homelessness system, that just naturally creates hopelessness. And these children are constantly being turned away and re-traumatised. The focus on early intervention is generally ineffective and takes resources from the more effective programs. Survival takes all your resources during homelessness, so there's not a lot left for anything else. There's a gap in homelessness services for children because of the grey legal responsibilities between child protection and homelessness services. There's a lack of access to community mental health supports for people with complex mental health needs and people either being too complex or not complex enough. Emergency rooms become the first point of call for homeless people in crisis, but emergency rooms have a policy for not discharging into homelessness, which creates a barrier to accessing treatment for homelessness people especially young people who often need a parent or guardian's permission to access support.
What are the most pressing issues in the system currently, and how can they be improved?
So I think something that's really reflected in these reports is that the government is actively trying to pretend that we don't exist. They're working to solve a problem that they created without any acknowledgement of the suffering that they caused. And we need to keep talking about it. We need to reach out to the decision makers in our communities and make our voices heard so that they can't keep silencing us. And then with the way that the homeless system works right now, there's an inability to cater to complex needs. And all homeless children have complex needs inherently. And there's an inability of services to support those kids. And that means those kids can't get support. And with the lack of recognized minimum standards in the crisis housing and homelessness system, there are gross violations of human rights of the people forced to access these spaces. And there is nowhere for them to complain. There is nowhere for them to get support. And with pay inequality for young people, there's less opportunities for them to access housing. And there's also, I think, one of the greatest problems right now is the network of institutional violence that leads back to homelessness, with young people having to leave education early due to poverty and enter the workforce, but not being able to access stable housing because you can't access higher paying employment due to not completing your education. And poverty leads to homelessness, and homelessness leads to not having healthcare, and lack of healthcare stops you from being able to work, and you're forced to steal to eat, which leads to incarceration, and now you have a criminal history, and it all starts again. And this is all by design, but this design is what is keeping kids on the street.
So with all that said, what can we as a community do right now?
So we at Crisis Housing Reform are working to create a crisis housing system that is more able to respond to everyone's needs. And if you have experience of crisis housing, or if you feel like you can help, you can get in touch with us at Crisis Housing Reform on Instagram. And something that you can do in your personal life is talk about it with people to make sure that they're aware that this is happening. Also, donating supplies and money to people in your local community. If you know of homelessness services, if you know of homeless people in your community, talking to them, offering support. Instead of donating things to your local off shop, donate them to your local community service. Also, supporting your local community. Participate in mutual aid, get to know your neighbours. When you connect with the community, it means you know when something is happening. You're more able to help. I think it's important to remember that at best, everyone is a few disasters away from homelessness. It's not an us or them problem. It's an everyone problem.
I think, yeah, homelessness can affect anyone at any time. And if you were to ask me even 3 months before I became homeless, if I thought I would ever become homeless, I would have said absolutely not. And looking at me or Tyler or a lot of people, you would never think that that person had gone through homelessness. So I think just treating it with compassion, and yeah, it's definitely not an us or them, or it can literally affect anyone. And also, just if you know someone going through homelessness, just be really kind. I had a few comments when I was homeless that you're not really homeless. Stop lying on your back with your hands in the air and legs in the air and not doing anything about it. So, yeah, I think just being really kind and compassionate.
I think also something that might be helpful is there are things that you would never think of donating to a homeless shelter that could be really helpful, like old work clothes that don't fit, nappies.
Even like a bassinet that you're not using, obviously, that it's still safe and clean. Toys, like we all do a big sweep of all the toys and take them to the op shop, take them to the homelessness services.
When young people get into housing, they're starting from zero. They don't have family to help them get set up. Even old furniture that you're trying to get rid of, all of those things are really, really helpful to a kid who's starting out from zero.
That was the second part of an interview with Tyler and Danny from Crisis Housing Reform. You can find out more about their work and get involved on Instagram at Crisis Housing Reform. And if anything covered in that interview causes stress or raises questions, you can contact the Suicide Callback Service on 1300 659 467, and First Nations listeners can also call 13YARN or 139276.
That's all we've got time for today on Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. Just to recap, we had an amazing two-part interview that Inez conducted on the AFL Grand Final and the concerns about alcohol and other drug use, domestic and family violence and gambling, and what can be done around safety planning. And we'll have resources in our show notes. We also heard episode 3 of Our Stories, Our Flats. Stay tuned next week for the final episode. And we were joined by the incredible Tony Birch to discuss the upcoming launch of Pictures of You. And Tony has given us Find Me at the Jaffa Gate by Michaela Sahar for a special giveaway. So if you want to get this copy of Find Me at the Jaffa Gate by Michaela Sahar, please send us a message on Instagram. That is at 3CR Thursday Breakfast before next Tuesday, and we will pick and announce a winner on air on our program next week. So again, head to at 3CR Thursday Breakfast on Instagram. Send us a message to enter the draw to win Find Me at the Jaffa Gate by Michaela Sahar. We will catch you next week, and thank you so much, as always, for tuning in. Take care, everyone, and please have a safe weekend. Bye.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical independent bookseller and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs in the basement of Trades Hall in Victoria Street, Carlton, or check them out at nibs.org.au to find more information about upcoming discussions and events.